Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Gersaw podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me today, as usual, is co-host Joel.
That's what I am. But I have something to tell you, Spencer.
What is that?
I'm not actually your co-host, Joel. I'm actually a man who's been paid to look just like Joel, act just like Joel, smell just like Joel. You wouldn't be able to tell because we do this over Skype, but trust me, okay. It's there.
So did he have to wear glasses before?
No, actually, during one of the epic battles, he became myopic.
Oh, okay.
As can happen when a cannonball explodes near your head, I guess.
Okay, does that explain the beard and stuff?
No, he just likes beards.
Oh, okay. But what if the real Joel loses an eye or an arm?
Well, he lost a foot, from diabetes, so that's close enough. I've already been through the pain, let me tell you. No, that didn't happen. How's it going?
It's pretty good. It's been a while since we recorded.
Yep.
I've been working on Jailhouse 701 stuff.
Yeah, you're watching all them movies with the ladies in prison?
Not all. I'm going to switch it up. I'm going to do Battles with Honor and Humanity pretty soon, which is challenging because there's so many fucking movies of that series.
Hey, you're doing it to yourself. That's what you got to keep in mind.
Yeah, I know, but they're kind of good. But just like, Jesus Christ, there are so many characters to keep track of.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this episode is the second half of the 1963 pairing. We just did an episode with Chris Funderburg from The Pink Smoke on High and Low. And now we're talking about a movie called The Third Shadow Warrior. Daisan no Kagemusha, directed by Umetsugu Inoue.
Umetsugu Inoue, that's what I would say too.
Yeah. It's based off a novel by Noseo Nanjo, and the screenplay is by Seiji Hashikawa. So, did you know about this movie before?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Did you?
Nope. I kind of picked it because there was, like, two Kinoshitas, and that was kind of really it to pick from. That was easily available.
Yeah.
Without spending, like, $40 on an import DVD. Yeah, so this is a... I guess this is kind of another action movie we're doing.
It's kind of an action movie. It's like an action drama horror, like, because it definitely has horror elements.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Faith of Another.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see
and,
that.
And, like, Faith of Another and the Kurosawa film Kagemusha, obviously.
Yeah, in fact, if you try to find... Like, Kagemusha obviously is a term that people used. If you try to find, a Wikipedia article about it, it doesn't exist. You look up Kagemusha, it takes you to the Kurosawa movie.
Hmm. Yeah, basically it's meant like a double for a lord.
Right. It's a very specific thing, but it's also interesting. Like, it's a real thing.
Yeah, like Saddam Hussein had doubles who had plastic surgery.
Yeah, exactly.
And stuff. I mean, it's common. I'm sure Trump has doubles and Obama had doubles.
Yeah. Yeah, Trump just makes a Cheeto snowman. And nobody can tell the difference.
Well, he is kind of stupid. Maybe he doesn't have doubles because he thinks it's a waste of money.
Probably.
I won't put
it. Well, he's got two doubles. He's got those two sons.
Yeah. This episode, because last one ran a little long, we're going to, after discussing Third Shadow Warrior, We're going to say our top three Kurosawa movies we covered so far and top three non-Kurosawa movies we covered so far. And not just sort of like the ones that are technically the best and ones that are just like, you know, like your favorite movie isn't necessarily a best movie ever made. It's just what really speaks to you on some level.
Sure.
So we're going to do a little bit of that. This movie's kind of pretty simplistic when you really look at it.
Yeah, it's the story is not very complicated. That's true. It has some very good film elements, though.
Yeah, other than the slight, but I'm just happy it wasn't like High and Low where I had to take a lot of notes to keep track of like everything.
Yeah.
Or like what was another one?
That's a good contrast to High and Low too, because you know, typically when we try to find a movie from the same year, the movies turn out being, you know, similar, very, very similar. This one is not very much like High and Low, mostly because of, like, it's, you know, a period piece movie, but it's also very, I don't know, is it very violent? It's got some gore in it going on, so.
Yeah, it's definitely, I guess when it was, I'd say it's almost as violent as Hunter in the Dark.
Yeah, it's definitely on that level. And like, not, you think of Yojimbo with its famous like arm scene where the you know, somebody's arm gets cut off and you see it on the ground.
Yeah, and there's a blood splatter.
Right.
Where a guy corners a guy.
And this one is way more gruesome. Like when people get limbs cut off, like the camera seems to like just hold on it, like, hey, look at this. Like, no, that's okay. You don't have to do that.
Yeah, it reminds me of another movie from this time called Samurai Spy. That's on Criterion for some stupid reason. That's a kind of a hyper, like a lightly, like hyper violent samurai movie that is kind of not very good, but has good, like, limbs getting severed off.
It's famous for its limbs.
Yeah, I don't like Samurai Spy. If you disagree with me, I don't care. It's not a good movie.
Spencer, it's in the Criterion Collection. It must, well, like opens up with a you know, a bunch of text on screen telling you the time period and what's going on. I didn't really pay attention to that stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's actually based on anything true, but I know it's based off a book. And
Jidaigaki? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yes. Basically, a period piece about samurai, and there's a lot of sword fights. That's all it really means. And, I like that. Not sure if you've noticed, but this is the first Daiei film we covered.
The first what?
Daiei. It's a lesser-known studio.
Mm.
They did some of the kaiju stuff. Not like Mothra or Godzilla, but they did other ones that aren't famous, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the turtle one, I think, was them.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, the name flew out of my brain.
Gamera?
Gamera, yeah.
Yeah, I think Gamera is a Daiei property, but like, I don't really haven't seen much of their stuff from this time.
Hmm. No, IMDb is useless for looking up things by studio. I was just trying to find it. I had to go to Letterboxd or something like that.
Yeah.
Too lazy.
Yeah, like most of we've done, Shochiku, the Ozu studio. It's at family dramas, Toho, and that's Nikatsu, obviously.
So, yeah, this, let me just get into this plot here. This tender plot morsel made just for us. So the real story of this, the third Shadow Warrior question is this young farmer who gets recruited suddenly by a samurai who has stopped by their family farm. The opening of this movie actually shows all these, like, samurai warriors, like, running around on their horses, almost running these farmers over. You know, they don't care. And one of them drops a severed head and makes this guy pick it up. You know, this poor farmer who's never seen violence like that before. Like, pick that up and give it to me. Because, you know, bringing back a severed head, that's how you get some cash money.
Yeah, I think it was the enemy warlord or something.
Yeah, like that. Who knows? Some daimos, you know, some lords. Not even like one of the lords. It's like the soldiers' heads or something. Like, this was the general. I'm going to get slightly less money than you are. A race to get severed heads there. But
well, that's how you'd prove that you killed someone.
Oh, that's true. Like, that could be anybody's head, you know? Who's who knows? Nah. I guess they could tell. If
you're famous enough, you'd know.
Yeah, they're famous, that's true. Yeah, so this wandering... The samurai pulls up on his horse and he says, would you like to be a samurai to this kid? And this young farmer, that's all he wants. He doesn't want to be a farmer. He wants to make a name for himself and get lots of money. So...
Yeah. He wants to move up,
yeah,
in society. I read this is also part satire on Japanese society at the time with class.
Yeah,
which I see elements of it, but I don't think it's as strong as like say something like High and Low.
Right. Absolutely not. Once it gets rid of that, the beginning area with the, you know, the whole farmer's life and stuff like that, we don't really touch on it again.
Yeah, and this farmer has a father and a brother?
Yeah.
Is it a brother? Do you have a sister, too?
No, that's just the father and the brother.
Okay. There's a woman who shows up later who knew him, who I think maybe was like his sister or sister-in-law or something.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We'll get to it.
All right. Anyways, so yeah, young farmer goes with them. The samurai, like, makes him put on a hat so nobody sees what he looks like and takes him into, like, basically into the lord's house. So he's not even a recruit samurai. He already knows. This young farmer doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, he was essentially kind of like picked up by a creep in a Wonderless van. Like, hey, you want some candy?
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, they gave my family money, and now I'm going on to who knows where. Yeah, and he gets taken to a room where there are no candles, or there's no lights, and they make him sit down, and then slowly two other people light candles that are right next to him, and I think we're supposed to look at them and be like, oh my god, they look identical. These people do not look identical, but for the purposes of the movie, they do.
Well, they look similar enough.
I mean, they've got the same eyebrow, they've all got the same clothes on, the same robes, they've got their hair styled the same way. But it's, yeah, what we're doing is he specifically recruited this young farmer because he looks just like the lord of this castle. Lord Yasutaka, right?
Yeah. Ikemoto.
Mm-hmm. Yasutaka of Hide is what he becomes because he's taking over this region. And it's just it's tradition to have these, Saddam Hussein style duplicates so that, you know, when you're out on the battlefield, if something happens, it doesn't actually happen to the Lord. If he's out making a speech, someone tries to assassinate him, it doesn't happen. And you have multiples of these people so that it could always seem like he's able to be you know, awake and aware at all points.
Yeah, the two other guys are there for other purposes, because one is for combat.
Yeah, one's for combat,
and the other one I don't remember.
I don't either. And then he is brought in, the young farmer is brought in to be the house double. So he's going to live in the Lord's house and take the Lord's place for, like, meetings and stuff like that whenever he needs to. And so there's a, you know, a very specific training regimen. The Lord has a limp because he sprained an ankle. And so he walks with a natural limp. He is very boisterous. He's very loud. So, and this farmer, of course, being, he's super meek. So he has to learn to, like, laugh. And he has this mannerism where he carries this horsewhip with him everywhere. And he just smacks it on the ground whenever he wants to emphasize anything he's saying.
Yeah, that's definitely like a Toshiro type character.
Yeah. And eventually we see this lord talking to a bunch of his generals in the room, and that's the same actor, right? And he, after the speech, he goes up and he meets the new shadow, and he's like, oh, this guy looks just like me. I don't like that at all. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
It's weirding me out.
And then immediately one of the people in the court comes by, and it's his first test.
Yep.
And he passes.
Yep. It's like his footman, who should be able to recognize him by standing there, and he does not recognize him.
Yeah, and the training, didn't really get that much into it. It's combat training, and you have to learn how to, like, speak in his cadence and his vocabulary. They have to. There's a scene where they're all just walking, like, in a line and trying to do the limp perfectly. And it's kind of really frustrating to watch it because he keeps getting yelled at. Like, no, you're going too far. That's not enough. Your steps are too big.
Yeah, it has to be exact right.
So the farm's the house double, so he gets the lessons with the mistress.
Yeah, he needs to learn how to make love like the Lord does. Because I guess the Lord's not going to be able to do it sometimes. he has a schedule to keep.
I guess, so she wouldn't know, but...
Right. Like, well, this is like, if this ever happens, this is inevitability where, for some reason... the Lord is sick and we can't show that. I think that's what happens. Like, the Lord is the Lord of the castle is got like the flu or something. And so he has to go sleep with his formerly favorite mistress that he hasn't been spending time with. Yeah, but this turns out to be a huge flaw in this whole shadow thing, because who knows the body of the Lord more than the person who gets to see it, you know, often?
Yeah, like, of course she would be the one who can tell a difference.
Yeah. And he's just got a completely different penis, so no, that's not what gives him away. But.
I mean, it has to be, right?
Well, have you seen the movie Dave with Kevin Klein?
Oh, no.
It's like the same story, because so maybe the penis isn't distinguishing enough, even if you are very familiar with somebody.
I guess. I'm not a woman or a man in that position.
Only one way to find out.
No. Yeah. Get ready, Joel.
God, help me.
Shortly after, like, the test, there's a first big battle against the Miki.
I don't know. There's like five different lords that are all fighting.
Yeah, there's two other kingdoms. nearby.
I don't know if they're fighting the Miki. I think they're fighting a different group, and the Miki are the ones that are, like, kind of in between deciding on who...
Oh, yeah, you're right. The Miki are trying to figure out who to side with for their own gain, and I don't remember if I wrote down the other ones. I don't think I wrote down the other kingdom.
No, they're just out there. They're just other people.
Yeah, it's not that relevant, really.
Right. And Ikemoto's army is thought to be the one that's going to, like, roll over everybody. Like, they're already taking over part of the kingdom. And so the Miki family have a meeting. They're trying to decide who they want to side with, and they inevitably decide to join with the Ikemoto clan. And by doing this, they're going to have the daughter of that lord of that clan,
Princess Teru.
Yes, the most beautiful woman out of all of Hida.
Yep,
I guess
that's what they keep on saying.
Yep. And yeah, that's just setting up the thing. That's more of the storyline that's going to be happening during one of these battles. Our lord is out there on his horse running around. By the way, every time they go out to battle, all three of the other Shadow Warriors go. It's not just the one who's supposed to be pretending to him, like, during the battle. For some reason, yeah, all three of them are on the field.
That's probably just in case one of them gets killed. Or maybe, like, the battle one gets killed. So then they have to put in the other ones.
Right. And like we said, this lord is boisterous. He's running around on his horse like crazy. He's like, I think he would be easy to spot, but he gets knocked off his horse in a very specific way. And they grab him and they drag him down to the riverbed so that nobody can see if he's been injured or not. And he got an arrow in the eye.
Yep, the left eye.
He got a arrow in his eyeball, and he's still alive, so I guess it didn't penetrate his brain. But whoever made that shot, they need to get a raise.
Yeah, the violence in this movie was very well done.
Yeah, it's like, I've seen eye trauma before in movies, like in horror movies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I laugh.
Cringe. I hate eye trauma.
Well, I don't like, things don't tend to look very realistic to me. Like, and I have to say on this, yeah, with him, you know, sitting on the cliff with this fake arrow sticking out of his eye, that wasn't too bad. You know, it's not good, but it's not too bad. Later something else happens that I found absolutely, like, unnerving.
Yeah, well, the eye trauma at all freaks me out. Like in the terrible Italian horror movie Zombie, or Zombie 2, whatever, I think it's Zombie 2, there is a woman who gets stabbed in the eye with a piece of, what do you call it? Like a big splinter of wood.
Yeah.
And it is painful.
Thinking on our young farmer's part, he wraps a bandage around his own left eye, runs up the cliffside and says, "I'm still alive, let's go fight." And it, you know, that rallies the army, so they, even though it was looking not so good for them, they end up winning that battle for the day. The one thing that all these Kagemusha have is they complain that they don't have a life because they have to exist in the shadows. Literally, they can't leave the palace the castle just in case somebody will notice them and be like, "Hey, like that's the Lord," or "That's not the Lord." You know.
Basically, they, like, live in, like, the pool house outside the mansion.
Yeah, and they're all talking about how, like, "Oh, I'm gonna, when I get enough money, I'm going to leave, go home, and, you know, I'll be the richest man in my village," and all this stuff like that. You know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking just knowing, like, they were duped into this horrible job.
Yeah. Promises of money and glory. So,
yeah, like,
yeah,
like
when the,
real,
mm-hmm.
But I'm like, if you, but realistically, like, they would, in that, if you were a Kagemusha, you would probably die before you get to live your own life.
Exactly, yeah. Unless the Lord dies and, like, everybody is aware that that happened, and then, you know, even then, you're probably going to get killed because it's all part of some conspiracy, right?
Yeah, because you can't have someone look like you after you're dead.
Yeah.
Then that would just ruin the image of, like, royalty or power.
Right. Loose lips. Somebody's going to talk and tell somebody and ruin the reputation of King Jimmy.
Yeah.
So they go back to the castle after this victory and people are celebrating, you know, the three Shadow Warriors are sitting around their own fire, you know, because obviously they can't celebrate with the men. They're talking about that. And they're talking about, like, oh, I wish we could go celebrate. We had a huge victory today, you know. And one of them is like, I'm scared. They're like, what are you scared about? You know, we got this good sake they brought us. Everything is like, it's like, I'm scared because we're made to look exactly like the Lord of this castle. And they all look at each other like, oh, shit. And then...
Yeah, and that's...
Yeah.
And then the samurai... What's his name?
This dirtbag. I don't know what this dirtbag's name is.
Saheta Shinomura. Yeah, he was like the guy who recruited all of them.
Yeah.
He comes in and is like, hey, you guys want some new sake? And then he's like, okay, now you're going to get your left eye poked out.
The doctor will be by right now. He's like they're not even giving us a second.
Yeah, and he's just all smiles like, oh, by the way, there's painkiller and the sake.
Yeah, this is this is your duty, so there's no question about it.
Yeah.
And one of them is like, hell no. And he tries to run. But he's obviously he doesn't get very far because that this recruiter guy just takes out his sword and cuts him down in front of the other two as an example.
He seemingly like teleports to where he's going to show up.
Yep.
Because you immediately know like, oh, this has happened thousands of times before. He knows where they're going to go. And then he just kills them as example, as like, well, you signed up for this, and you're going to get your eye poked out with a hot blade.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to happen. You know, you guys, or this is your choice. You're either going to die, or we're going to get poked out. And don't worry, you're going to get more money. Everything's going to be fine, but this has to happen. Yeah. So one of them gets taken, when the doctor shows up, one of them gets taken behind a screen. And we're watching our poor farmer just sit there waiting. And you hear, you know, because obviously this has been done. And the farmer starts drinking very heavily from the medicated sake. And the other guy comes around. He's got a bloody bandage all over his face where his eye once was. And a more subtle filmmaker might have been like, okay, it's your turn. Come around here and, like, you know, fade it out because we know what's going to happen. No, this movie takes you around to the other side where the doctor is. You see his bloody, you know, knife, his bloody scalpel or whatever.
And, like, the mat that they're on is all bloody, too.
Yep. And, you know, we stick with him. We stick with him while he, like... gets down on his knees, the guy has to force him because he's afraid. But eventually he stands there, he holds his face. The doctor kind of wipes off the tool. There's no like topical anesthetic. Obviously this is like the 1500s or whatever.
Yeah, it's 1564.
Yeah. And we see a first person view of the doctor holding the scalpel, moving it towards you. That's what got me. Because it's like, I can already imagine. Like, don't do this.
Yeah, it's... it's kind of like the one moment that goes too far in this movie.
Yeah. Well, I think there's another moment that's pretty gruesome, but it's not as... It doesn't feel as, like, personally painful, because it's kind of over the top. But yeah, this is like, oh, man. You don't see the blade go in or anything like that. It's just done really well. My compliments to them, but... Ugh.
No. Yeah, it's just... I don't know. I'm curious to read accounts of actual Kagemusha, but at the same time, I kind of don't want to know what their lives were like.
Yeah.
After watching this.
Yeah. Now, the other guy's lucky that didn't happen to him. But the whole story behind that other one was the...
You know, they really aren't that important, really. They're just kind of, like, I guess, like, the only source of lightness in the movie.
Yeah. Well...
And then... What?
Wait, who are you talking about? The actual Shadow Warriors?
Yeah, I think the Shadow Warriors are the other two guys are the only sources of lightness in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Because everyone else is just taking full advantage of their blind faith in the Lord.
Yeah. This movie has silly parts in the beginning, yeah, but after this point, it's just kind of a race to how terrible things can be.
Yeah. And so, this is like midnight, 1 a.m. type, like, time of the day, and so a couple hours after the painful surgery...
Yeah, this just happened.
There's a surprise attack.
Yep, the other army returns and attacks their castle directly, which they totally weren't expecting. They're not prepared for. You know, a bunch of their army are drunk or hungover from celebrating all night. So they run in there and they just start taking out a whole bunch of people, like a bunch of the main characters that have, you know, were part of the training regiment and other soldiers that we saw occasionally. They're getting cut down as we're watching. And they're trying to rush the Lord out. The Lord who also, like we said, just had that injury today. So he's got like a thing on his head. But the other two doubles have like a full-on mummy almost going on for their injury. And they're trying to run out. And people are like, oh, there's the Lord right there. You know, get him. And the two... Kagemusha are being directed to get the Lord out of there. So they start to run in one direction. And then the recruiter guy is like, hey, you, if you really want to do what you can, you need to die for the Lord right now, to the other double, not the farmer. He's like, what? I don't want to do that. He's like, too bad. He throws him back to the group.
Yeah, and he gets a bunch of arrows.
He gets a ton of arrows. Like, they must have reloaded. Like,
yeah, it reminds me of a certain Kurosawa movie that we will get to at some point.
I think the only other Kurosawa movie I've seen at this point is Madadayo. So I don't think you're talking about that one.
No. We'll get to that other one.
Is it Ran?
Where?
No. It's Ran, isn't it?
No, it's another.
Is it Redbeard?
No. Nope.
It's Redbeard.
It's not Redbeard.
Is it Dodeskaden?
Nope.
Oh, man. Is it...
Dodeskaden's set in modern Japan.
Yeah, but people have arrows.
Well, that's true.
Is it the other Shakespeare one that we haven't done?
It could be the other Shakespeare one.
Yay! I don't remember what that one's called.
Oh. It's his Macbeth one.
Right.
And in it, they use actual arrows. And Teishiro could have been killed because they use actual arrows for, like, him running around getting shot at.
Oh, so that's why he stopped working with him.
And it's kind of terrifying. And also, the Intoho did not have insurance would not cover that.
Arrow fights.
So if he, yeah, so if he died, then that's it. His family gets nothing.
You know, he should have had his own Kagemusha. That would have fixed it.
Yeah, it's Toshiro, so he's going to do it himself.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, so our young farmer Kagemusha is running along with the actual Lord here. And, by the way, the Lord does get injured as he's leaving the castle. He gets chopped in the arm pretty bad. So they're running out, and they make their way to this area where there's a little stream of a waterfall behind some trees to hide out all they can. The Lord is obviously not doing good, but he's protesting, he's fighting, we gotta keep going, we can't stop here. But before we go on, I need you to chop my left arm off. It's like, what? Like, wait. Okay, so he's bleeding from his left arm, right? How is chopping his left arm going to fix the issue?
Maybe it's just beyond repair at that point.
I mean, sure, but I mean, is he?
Well, it is an order from his master, so he kind of has to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he does. But I don't understand what the logic behind it. Like, unless his arm was like hurting really bad. But even then, like, I don't think cutting the entire arm off is going to fix the pain he's having.
Well. Maybe he just wasn't thinking straight, given his physical state.
Yeah, huge amount of blood loss, sudden eye missing. He probably has brain damage, yeah.
Yeah, maybe he's, you know, he's a little kind of real loopy.
Yeah, he keeps telling him, don't worry, you're going to get rewarded for this, right? Cut my arm off. So he cuts the Lord's arm off, and this is the part where I was talking about, where we're just looking at this wound where his arm used to be, you know, gory, bloody stuff. And the Lord is still stumbling around like, we still got to make it. I can still go. Everything's fine. And the farmer, he did this. He cut this guy's arm off without even thinking about it, right? And eventually he realizes, no, we can't continue on. If we get to that place, they're going to cut my arm off. Like, yeah. That's what I was thinking when he did it. Like, I was sitting on my couch and I was like, don't cut his arm off. Don't cut his arm off. Oh, man, you're such an idiot. So, yeah.
Well, and the Lord is making a lot of noise. Yep. So.
Yeah, and there's a whole army looking for both of them, looking for anybody. So he decides to strangle him. And good on him, because I wouldn't want to have my arm cut off either.
And he had the good excuse of, well, we were, you know, ambushed or whatever. He has a good cover.
Yeah. There's that. He's basically like, you're ruining my life. Everything you're doing is ruining my life, which is an honest reaction.
So,
well, no, we jump forward in time at this point. He's trying to make his way across, you know, like, they're basically all of Yasutaka's base has been destroyed. They took the castle. Most of his army has been scattered. You know, nobody knows where all the lords are. And he's just going through a village with one of those rice paddy hats on. So, hoping that no one will recognize him. And he bumps into one of the women who trained him. And she's like, oh my gosh, you're still alive. You know, where's the Lord? He's like, oh, he died. He died of his wounds. Like, well, we're still, you know, a couple of us are still around. And they're trying to find, nobody knows if the Lord is alive or dead or whatever. And then the guy who recruited him also happens to be right there, and he's like, hey, I got an idea.
You be the new Lord.
I mean, it's exactly what you would think was going to happen here. Like, this guy looked the most like the other Lord. The only person who's been able to tell him, like, there's a part where we see the Miki clan. Is that what they are, Miki? And they're talking about the news reports, whether the Lord's alive, and like they say, well, they thought they killed the Lord at the castle, but one of his concubines was able to identify him because he's got this mole on his body, and the double didn't have the mole. So, yeah, that's just showing that people don't know whether the Lord is alive or not. The recruiter's like, all right, we're going to put you up as the Lord. We're going to march you back in there like you're still alive and it was successful. And the less people who know about this, the better. So he just kills the other lady that's right there. This guy's just got the jerk reputation deserved. And they eventually do roll back into this castle. They're at the Miki's castle, though. Miki's castle.
They're in Maxwell Kingdom?
Right. And they're saying, like, oh, yep, you're still going to marry the beautiful princess and everything like that. We do actually hear from the beautiful princess who's talking about how she doesn't like that she's being used as this prize, as this tool, and
refreshing to see a strong female character from a Japanese movie from this time.
Yeah. She doesn't want to be a
treasure?
A doll, I think is what she says. Yeah. Just a doll for whatever they need. And at this point, Kiyonosuke is telling everybody, you know, he's the Lord. He has to pretend full time that he is the Lord. Yasutaka, that is. And they're getting ready to plan to take back the castle. And the guy who recruited him is like, you have to be Yasutaka all the time. You can never be yourself again at this point, if we're going to be able to pull this off. And his reaction is to get on his horse and ride off as fast as he can, because it's, you know, it's terrible to have to do that. But as he's riding through the countryside, he rides by
Kahaji.
Kahaji, who was his, the Lord's former favorite concubine. And he stops, and, you know, he stops for a pit stop or whatever. And she, after they do whatever they do, which they don't show, there's no, like, lovemaking, there's no lady stuff going on in this movie. She reveals to him that she knows that he's not actually Yasutaka.
And she knew the whole time.
That's right. I knew someone as good and as nice as you couldn't be the Lord. Also, you don't have that mole that he has.
Yeah, and he was too nice.
Mm-hmm?
And too attentive to her in the lovemaking to be him.
Yeah. And she begs him to run away with her. Like, we could go live our lives. We don't have to go back to this. But at this point, Kiyonosuke has gotten this taste for the power. Like, he's finally in the lordly position that he wanted to be.
Yeah, he's gone from a peasant to, you know,
like, literally the lord of a castle. And he tells her that I can't do this, you know, maybe after I finish that, you can come back and join me, you know, as my concubine again, but I'm not going to leave when I finally reached my dreams, you know. So he goes back, he's taking over Lord Yasutaka's life. There's a part where his brother shows up at the castle.
Oh, yeah, and the recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
Tells him everything.
Yep.
And then kills him, so he has an excuse to keep the double in line.
Yeah. He doesn't want Kiyonosuke to have any outside, you know, he doesn't want anyone to be able to identify him. So takes out the brother. And then he goes and he tells Kiyonosuke that he did this. And there's nothing he can do about it at that point, you know? It's like, we're both involved in this lie, and the lie is too big.
Yeah, and then he also reveals that his father died.
Yeah. Well, that's why his brother came in the first place.
Yeah. Says, oh, your father died. Oh, and I killed your brother, too.
Yep. So, there is a scene between Kiyonosuke and this princess or whatever she is, where they just talk about their ambitions, and the woman is talking about how she wishes she was a man because all she wants to do is become as powerful as she can, to rule as much of this land as she can. And she's got this beautiful kind of like balcony situation for her room, where you see the countryside and the mountains and everything looks gorgeous. She's like, I can look at it at any time, but it's not mine, and that's what I want. And so he, pretending to be Lord Yasutaka, says, well, then that's what I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you everything you want. And using that as a catalyst, he decides that he's going to go take back his old castle right now. And
even though his recruiter says, wait a couple months.
Yeah, we barely have an army at this point. You barely have anybody with you. Like, we need to stay here and gather our strength and rebuild our numbers, and then we can go do all of that. And he's like, no. I'm going to show her that I'm the man who can conquer this land or whatever. He's inspired. I know what that's like.
Sure you do.
Yeah, this one time I was like, I'm going to take over this McDonald's. That didn't happen.
Yeah, because Ronald caught you.
Launched me from a cannon.
And the Hamburglar stole your lunch.
I'm bringing back all these bad memories.
And the Grimace. What did the Grimace even do?
Well, he used to have four arms, and now he's only got two, and he used to be evil. He's just kind of there.
Okay.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's like the enforcer.
I guess. He's only one that's, I don't know.
Yeah. So he takes his few, his 100 men that he has left, and he does. He charges at the army that took over his castle, and I think he ends up winning the war that day, right?
Yeah, but loses almost all of his army.
And then, also another reason he did this is because they told him, you can't marry the princess until... until you take back your castle, you know. So he goes, he does it. He comes back. They get married. A little ceremony. The wedding night, he goes, you know, he's ready. He's excited. He's having the time of his life all of a sudden. And this other guy comes in
he wasn't the Lord. He was like an advisor.
Yeah, Sanemitsu.
Yeah, he was trying to weasel his way into being the Lord, even though he couldn't be.
Yeah. Shigeru Imachi, playing Sanemitsu. And he's, like, related to this princess. I don't know if they're cousins or what. But basically, he slides in there, and he's like, ha! By the way, we know you're not the Lord. We've known for quite some time. You have no army because you've just sacrificed all these men to take back this castle. And this lady that you're so interested in? Yeah. I'm actually the one who's hooking up with her. So, sorry, dude. You're going to have to continue to pretend to be Yasutaka.
Yeah.
It's like, well, no, can't you just let me go back to being the guy I was before, you know? Like, it's like, nope. You can't do it. You're going to have to sleep with your concubine who told us the whole truth this whole time. And, you know, they reveal that she's right there. So he's really upset that he doesn't get to sleep with this lady. He's devastated. I thought I was finally going to get the... Yeah, anyway. Oh, yeah, I've totally seen Shigeru Amachi. And he was in Sinners of Hell, or what's that called?
Jikaku.
Yeah, that's right. I recognized his... He's got, like, a naturally evil-looking face.
Was he the creepy friend? Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. He seemed very familiar.
Yeah, he's been a Zatoichi. I've seen that too, yeah. He's trying to... He's like the... what word I'm looking for? He's the knockoff version of Nakadai.
Yeah. He's like Nakadai if he could only play villains. Yeah,
exactly. And at first... He's kind of like, well, okay, I guess I'll be with my concubine. This really sucks, but okay, I guess I could take it. So they kick him out of the main room. He goes to the other room. And his concubine is like, you know, I know this seems terrible at first, but it's going to be fine. And you and me and our baby we're going to be okay. And maybe we can get away at some point. And he's like, what? Oh my gosh, you're pregnant? So... This genius, Kiyonosuke, hears that she's pregnant and runs back into the other room where the princess and this dirtbag are already getting down to something. And he runs in and he's like, haha, you think that I'm the fake Yasutaka, but I have to tell you right now that my child is going to be born, and he will be born a lord. Because if I'm not going to sleep with the princess lady, then I guess this is going to be my only heir. So the trick's on you, dude. And the guy's like, well, actually, we already have a lord that is going to be, and your son is going to be coming from the princess.
Because he's going to be the father of her baby.
Because she's already pregnant with his baby.
Yeah.
Some soap opera shit.
And he, in the advisor guy, kills Kahaki.
Yeah, he takes this opportunity to go up to the concubine and is like, is this true that you're pregnant? And she's like, yes. He's like, okay, bye. Just cuts her down.
Yeah, man. I forgot the farmer's name.
Kiyonosuke?
Yeah, and so he starts trying, so he decides this, I don't know, maybe I'll just tell everyone the truth so that I can be executed.
Yep.
But no one believes him.
He'd rather be dead than have to live like this. And, yeah, no one believes him. The other guy convinces him that he's just gone mad because of the battle and stuff like that. And the end of the movie says that he lived for another 20 years, the whole time protesting that he was not Yasutaka, that he was Kiyonosuke. And eventually the evil dude and the other Miike clan members were killed when the castle was overrun. And they found a man in a cell, in one of the castle's cells, who would only say that his name was Kiyonosuke, and they just threw him away, you know, basically. Yeah. So he had a terrible, sad life. And I gotta tell you, this the ending of this movie upset me.
Because it's so sad.
Yeah. It's a huge pile of sad.
Yeah, I was expecting them to kill himself, not just play along with it.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, he's illiterate and uneducated, so, he probably wouldn't be that familiar with, formal customs of,
of murder-suicide?
Yeah.
I mean, I was just hoping that he'd pick up a sword and go back and kill this guy real quick, you know? Because he's shown himself to be, earlier in the movie, to be somebody capable of, of warrior tactics, of samurai tactics, because there's that part where he, like, is practicing shooting arrows. You know, he's getting the bullseye. Yeah. And obviously he knows how to use a katana, because he cuts off his master's arm, no problem.
Yeah, I don't know. The ending, that's like the only weak point for me.
Yeah.
It's this kind of unjustifiably sad, where I don't think it's earned. It doesn't make that much sense, given his character earlier on.
Yeah, but it is, I mean, it is part of the whole, like I said, after the point where they poke out his eyeball, it is kind of like a snowball into sadness.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it. I would recommend this.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's the only warning would be, if you're sensitive to, like, eye trauma, just be aware
definitely
that it's in this movie.
Yeah.
And, like, it does an interesting thing with give me a second, gotta let Fred out.
Alright.
Okay, I'm here.
Alright.
It's like a literal version of the saying of, once the legend is written down, it becomes truth. And so, with the double replacing the real one, like, I'm guaranteed this happened in history countless times, where the double outlived the real person, where, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, the real person actually died, but the legend of, like, that person lives on because he had a double take his place, and I appreciate that kind of take on, like, cultural myths and legends.
That's the Dread Pirate Roberts.
What?
The Dread Pirate Roberts from Princess Bride.
I haven't seen that in, like, 20 years.
It's time for a revisit.
I had it on VHS and watched it with all the time with my sister, but I don't remember it.
Well, it's a story about Columbo telling his young grandson about some you know, stuff.
I used to get that mixed up with the NeverEnding Story for some reason.
Oh, God, no.
I don't know why, but because we had both those on VHS, and for some reason, to me, they were the same thing.
I mean, they're both literally about people reading books and us as the audience entering a fantasy world, so I can see that. But I have to say that The Princess Bride is a much better done movie.
Okay.
Anyway, how does this movie, Daisen no Kagemusha, compare to High and Low, in your opinion?
It's both about social class and moving up. Not moving up. Where High and Low is about the literal differences between social class and your responsibilities in society within your social class. Where Third Shadow Warrior is about moving up in social class and fulfilling the role of being, like, a different class.
Yeah.
Where, like, he can't be the same old farmer anymore. He has to literally be the lord. He can't be himself with that much power. He has to perform. And so he kind of loses himself.
Yeah. They're both, the class distinction is the catalyst. Once again, that word, I'm just going to use that word all day, for the events of the movie. Because the person in High and Low is so poor, he's, you know, incredibly jealous of this person he imagines living on the hill. That starts all the garbage that happens in that movie.
Yeah, he assumes he has a perfect life because he has money.
Right.
But you know, not everyone, no one's happy.
Right. And in this movie, yeah, he imagines it must be glorious to be in battle and, you know, have money and not have to live this poor farmer's life. And it's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, he sees a literal horrors of war and the trappings of society.
Yep.
High and Low is definitely the better movie between
the two. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Goes without saying. I mean, this you know, Daisen no Kagemusha feels like a almost like a B movie. Oh, you know, like a Zatoichi adventure with a better plot than the average Zatoichi movie, but it's, you know, it's gory like those 60s movies are.
Yeah, it's kind of like a B movie done with like an A movie quality to it.
Yeah.
Like Tarantino movies are, and
A movie acting. Unless you want to talk about movies from 1963.
Yeah, let's do that first.
Alright.
I have a couple.
Now, are these movies you've actually seen or
No, I have seen these. One is, the first one is a little movie called This Sporting Life. It's directed by Lindsay Anderson. Lindsay is a man's name. He's British. And he directed the film debut of Malcolm McDowell, If. Have you seen If?
No.
It's really good, but very uncomfortable to watch it now. And look at the plot synopsis, you'll know what I mean. But his earlier movie, I think my one of his first, The Sporting Life, stars Richard Harris, the original Dumbledore, and father of actor Jared Harris, who's almost as good as father, but not quite, as this low-class rugby player, no, low-class coal miner, and he gets a tryout for a rugby team, and he becomes a huge superstar, but he can't quite break out of his being like a lower working class guy in a upper class world. And it's this very, very sad, melancholic sports drama that is really great because the rugby in it is like all actual like rugby where they're really going for it, and he gets really roughed up and messed up and gets like punched in the teeth and stuff. Like he goes for it in this movie, and it's really good.
The really real rugby.
Yeah, like I'm pretty sure he did not have a stunt double. I'm pretty sure he was like, no, I want to play rugby for real.
Yeah. Hold on a sec. Yes. All right. Sorry.
Yeah, The Sporting Life is on Filmstruck and Criterion. It's a really great sports movie.
Sports.
Yeah, you get to see how rugby is kind of barbaric and not fun to watch.
I've seen a rugby movie.
What is
Invictus? Isn't that one?
I thought that was soccer.
No, it's definitely about rugby.
Oh.
That's the Clint Eastwood directed one, right? With Matt Damon?
Yeah. And Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, it's rugby. Okay. I don't think it gets down and dirty though, or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't think Matt Damon's that type of actor. Yeah. Which is fine, but I don't think he's like willing to go that far for the role.
Oh, I don't know. He got all those robot parts for Elysium.
I guess.
So,
you got a 63. Yeah.
So there's a movie called Le Mani sulla Città. No, it's called Hands Over the City, directed by Francesco Rosi. It's in the Italian neorealism style. And it is, this is another movie that will fit into the theme of like class, you know, class misunderstandings, class warfare, if you will. Because it's all about several different like developers all trying to get their hands over this place that they want to, you know, start building new apartments or anything like that. Rod Steiger is the star of this movie, and I think he's like, I can't remember specifically. I saw this a long time ago, but I think he's speaking Italian. Does he play a racist in it?
Oh.
And,
when I hear Rod Steiger, I assume he's playing a racist.
Yeah.
Because I...
Well, he's Italian. He hates Italians, and he loves Italians. No, I don't know. And it's, like, it's just one of the really good movies all about this whole government corruption thing. Like, there are a whole bunch of... Italian movies from this era, just talking about how absolutely corrupt, like, money and just the whole government dealing with anyone who wanted to do something that would destroy, like, in this case, it, like, literally is going to destroy this land that the poorer people live on just to build these new buildings. And, like, we don't give a crap about them. Like, that's the double... meaning of the title of the movie, Hands Over the City, and literally they hand over the city to these people with money, and it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think I'm going to rewatch it now. not literally now, but
Where is it?
I don't know if it's on Filmstruck. That's where I originally watched it, on Hulu back when they had the Criterion. It's probably on Filmstruck.
Okay. Let's see. But
it's part of the Criterion Collection, so.
Okay. I have... There's actually a lot to pick from. I'm trying to narrow it down. My other one... I just lost it. Oh, Charade?
Yeah.
By Stanley Donen.
With your other girlfriend.
Yeah. No, I want to be Audrey's best friend. Okay. And Cary Grant plays, wait for it, Cary Grant. And Walter Matthau, you've probably seen Charade. It's a whole lot.
I have seen Charade, and the reason why you want to watch Charade is because it has the great George Kennedy in it, playing a man with a, I believe he has a hook for a hand, and an eye patch.
I vaguely remember him. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
George Kennedy, come on, you know what I'm talking about.
I know. It took a second. I don't remember him for a movie. I really remember Walter Matthau as a great villain. He's great. I'd never seen him that young before. It was jarring.
James Coburn. Yeah, it's got a cavalcade of 19, you know, that era stars there. But it's a funny movie. I think is one of the best parts. It's, you know, Hitchcock-esque without being Hitchcock.
That was kind of her character. Okay, and the last one an Italian.
Sorry, you should say Charade is actually available on YouTube in full because it's one of those movies that the studio lost the rights to it. And so... Oh. Yeah, like the first time I saw it like on a cheap DVD I got from like the dollar store, I think.
Oh.
It's like Night of the Living Dead. But there is a Criterion edition of it also.
Yeah, and it's on Filmstruck.
Yeah.
And I you should pay for it. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah, I just don't know where that money's going.
And it's Stanley Donen, and I believe he went on to direct Blame It on Rio.
Oh God.
That was his final film he directed.
Because he killed himself afterwards?
I don't know. It's just a big old, why did he make that?
Okay, listener, I don't know if you know about that movie, but that's like a pervert movie.
Yeah, it's...
One time... Yeah. Oh, man. This one time we were at the video store, and we had rented, I can't remember what we had rented, but we returned it after seeing it.
It was his last film.
And we asked the clerk, like, do you have any movie recommendations that you can tell us? And the clerk was like, oh, I think you'll like this film. And he handed us Blame It on Rio. And we didn't know anything about it at the time, but based on the cover, we didn't get it. And now I am so glad we didn't watch that movie. And you seem like a nice guy.
Yeah. Listen to the We Hate Movies episode on it instead of actually watching it.
Talking about making you cringe. There's eye gouging, and then there's Blame It on Rio.
Michael Caine, he has no shame.
No.
Okay, so the last movie... Wait. Did you say your second one?
I mean, I kind of did charade, too. What do you have?
Okay. It's an Italian movie by Vittorio De Sica. Oh, yeah. Called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Oh, yeah. Have you seen
it? No, but that cover, it's got that super sexy cover.
Yeah, it's Sophie Loren and Marcello Mastroianni. And it's just three vignettes about relationships. One is set in early 1900s Italy. One is set in like 1960s Italy. And one is set in the vague future. And it's all these different types of relationships and how, like, different people, you know, like, express love and, like, seek out romantic partners and stuff. It's a nice little movie. They're all totally very different, and you could see Marcello I didn't know he was that good of an actor until I saw this movie, because I only seen him in, like, kind of being stoic. And here, he can be real goofy.
Wait, who are you talking about?
Marcello.
I mean, he's in The Tenth Victim.
Yeah, but like, he's in Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, he gets to be more versatile with his role.
You haven't seen 8 and a half? He's not very yet. Stoic in that anyway. I mean, that's not really like a powerhouse acting thing, but yeah.
Marcello's really great.
Yeah, man, every time he comes up, I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. Or at least his performances.
Yeah.
I feel like he was in something that I used,
in,
used to watch as a kid, and I didn't know who the hell he was.
Probably. He's in a lot of stuff.
No. Oh, you know what? I'm thinking of the guy that was in something we did for Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. I can't remember the name of that movie. Never mind.
Yeah. Anyway, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. That Oscar, whenever that Oscars happened.
Cool. Yep. 64, I assume.
Yeah.
The only other one I wanted to mention is the original The Haunting. Now, if you're like me and you're in your 30s, you probably saw the remake of The Haunting from the 90s with Owen Wilson and Liam Neeson and Catherine Zeta-Jones and the actual star of the movie whose name I'm blanking on. And that movie is terrible. But it has these good things that happen in it. Like, they do a good job of making the house seem creepy when they're not CGI-ing everything out in the, you know, the walls and stuff like that. And it's got this atmosphere. And all of that stuff that's good in that movie came directly from the 1963 version of The Haunting directed by Robert Wise. This movie is so... Like... it's hard... Okay, I gotta formulate this sentence in my head. I hope you're going to edit some of this stuff out.
Yeah, some of it.
Edit. It's a black and white, and the characters are unaware of what's going on, and the purpose of them going to this scary house is that they are trying to do a study to prove that ghosts exist. Although the people who are there think they're there for a sleep study. And they set it up. The mansion already has these things that are supposed to be, you know, freaky on purpose. Like the doors close on their own, and the, you know, the professor guy explains that it's because they're built on a hinge so that they will close, and, you know, people mistake that for a ghost thing. And it just, it does a really good job. Like, The Haunting is such an apt title because it is a, it does such a good job of just being eerie and scary. And Julie Harris, who plays the main woman, does a really good job of, you know, being mysterious herself. And it's, I just can't recommend it enough if you haven't seen it. Like, if you were turned off by the 1990s version, forget that movie. Watch the 1963 movie.
Okay. I've heard, only heard good things about the 60s
Watch one. It now.
Is it on Filmstruck or?
I don't know. I have no idea. No. It's not, I don't think it's a Criterion movie.
Okay. So you got your top three.
Are we talking about this? What is this again?
Top three Kurosawa.
Oh, that we've covered?
Top three non.
All right. Do you want me to do all three?
Yeah.
All right. So these are in no particular order. Although The Hidden Fortress is now my favorite Kurosawa movie. I just think it's such a fun action ride. And yeah, it's got those characters that are not cool, but they don't get away with their, you know, their rapiness or whatever the characters are trying to do. And this, yeah. You know, like, I feel like it's standalone. I feel like it's famous for, you know, being one of the movies that heavily inspired Star Wars. But, like, disattach it from that. It's such a good movie.
Yeah, it's just a great adventure movie.
Visually stunning and just so much fun. And, like, what's his name?
Toshiro.
Yes, Toshiro obviously had a freaking awesome time doing this. Okay, so, and number two, Seven Samurai. I still think it's an epic masterpiece. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. I think the story is 3.5 hours long, but I feel like I could sit through it no problem, which is not very often a thing for me. Each of the characters are fleshed out so well, and the time period, it feels real. It feels like you're there, you know, in this dirty, you know, rogue samurai period.
Oh, yeah, it totally does.
And number three, High and Low. Because I just, I really dig a good detective tale. And after we get done with the one room drama in the beginning, it just becomes this whole cop procedural. And I dig it. I dig the way everything is like laid out. I dig all the, it's not just like, you know, three cops that are slowly putting stuff together. It is like the whole team of police are working together and attaching piece to piece as they clue together. We just talked about it, but yeah, I'm really glad we got to see that. And it's real good.
Okay. Do you have any honorable mentions?
I mean, you know, I like Yojimbo. I like all the other stuff. Dersu Uzala, I don't think gets enough love because people tend to just slide over it and go to Kagemusha. And as we talked about in the podcast, I think Dersu Uzala is the better movie.
Yeah, it definitely is. Let's see. So on that note, my top three in order is Dersu Uzala. That really caught me off guard. I didn't know what to expect with it, and it's just this beautiful movie about how powerful friendship is. And so I love the scope of it. I love just the characters. It's very simplistic and stripped down. It's, I don't know, like, there's just so much about that movie, and it appears so simple, but it's just this wonderful, like, little epic movie.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's like it's incredibly personal, but the scope of it is huge. Like, you get to see Russia in every season.
It's so it's beautiful. It is like one of the most gorgeous films. And when we talk about Dreams, I kind of feel Dreams is like near that level with its beautiful imagery. But there's something, it's so natural. You know, like they're in the forest, they're in the snow and all that stuff like that. And it's just like, it's masterful.
Yeah, they're in the, 125 degree summer. They're in the, negative 10 winter. Uh-huh. They're in it. It's like the physical aspect of it is insane because Kurosawa was 65 when he filmed it. And he was out there. And I wouldn't want to do that. Would yes. you?
I'm dying to.
Really?
But it's never going to happen.
Okay.
I want to be like Werner Herzog. I want to be out there sweating and dying.
Pulling a ship over a mountain.
And you fall in love with the characters. Like, Derzu himself is just like this, he's practically a wild man living out, being able to survive the way he does compared to the Russian soldiers. And the captain or whoever he is who is our audience surrogate.
Vladimir?
He's also just a wonderful person, and that's it's great.
Yeah, so Derzu and I and work on a secret project on that right now. I mean, an article I hope to get somewhere about male friendship, because there aren't many movies about male friendship, and that's one of the few out there.
What about Lethal Weapon?
It's just like comfort food to me. I can just sit down and watch Scandal any old time. I sit there and enjoy it and love it for some reason, even though I know it's not Kurosawa's best movie. I just have a real sweet spot for it.
Yeah, if it works for you, man, no, I still think it's a really good movie.
Yeah, it's one of the few times your father got to be in a starring role, and I just love seeing him in a starring role.
It's a little movie called Seven Samurai.
Yeah, but this is him playing a different character. And I really like Scandal. And for a third, I'm having a little trouble. I'm kind of stuck between Sanjuro and Yojimbo.
I mean, they're part of a pair, yeah.
Yeah. Like, everything that can be said about those has been said already. They're just these really great complimentary pieces on, something around this very roguish, like Han Solo type samurai in two separate adventures and how he grows as a person. At least how I interpret it.
They're Toshiro Mifune highlights. Like, they just show his range and just how blessed we were to have him.
Yeah, like, it's just, the movies are both really funny. They're both, well, one is much deeper than the other one. Sanjuro is just a fun little popcorn movie, essentially. Yeah. But still a great movie. Had my favorite fight scene, period. And, everything. I'm saying nothing new about it. Just, if you haven't seen those movies or heard those episodes, listen to episodes and watch the movies. Especially track down Derzu, because that just goes underappreciated.
And that was on Filmstruck. I'm not sure if it still is. But it's available on Amazon.
It's on DVD. Yeah, it's on DVD, but it's kind of not that easily available. It's kind of a little more an expensive side for me. At the Amazon video is dubbed.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah, it's going to give you a warning there. Because it's the Corman distribution version.
So, 3 non-Kurosawa?
Yeah. It could be from the special episodes, like the Suzuki one.
Sure. Yeah, we've covered a ton of movies. It's just some of them are all packaged together.
Yeah.
So, no particular order. Pigs and Battleships. That movie blew me away because I'd never heard of it. And it's just like this twisty, turny, solid, funny, like, crime movie. And, like, the funny thing is you know how it's going to end. You know everything that's going to end up happening, but you're along for this ride. Okay, sorry.
All right.
So, number two, Tokyo Drifter. Now, Pigs and Battleship is about gangsters, you know, small-time gangsters, basically. It's working down and dirty. That's another kind of deals with class and stuff like that. Tokyo Drifter is just a super stylized musical action movie. It's glossy. Yeah. It is so glossy. You have to wear sunglasses to be able to perceive everything that's going on. And it's just a lot of goofy fun. Like, I totally digged that. Like, it wasn't serious. It wasn't... I didn't have to worry about the details of who did what to who. And, like, the Tokyo Drifter himself kind of comes off as, you know, a Yojimbo, a samurai, having to go travel far and wide to avoid the trouble that he inevitably gets himself into. And it's just, like, it's a super polished movie, and it's a lot of fun. Number three, Good Morning, Ozu. I chose this out of all the other ones. We watched a whole bunch of different movies that I really enjoyed. And I choose this one because it's just makes your heart feel good. You know, it's very low key. It's very pretty colors. The way Ozu usually uses the full palette of colors when he does a color version of a movie. And children actors that are adorable. And it's just about, you know, a couple of different families all in a neighborhood. And, like, a day-to-day thing happening. Like, I don't know how I could paint this movie as being interesting when it's, like, just the concept is very uninteresting, but the movie is so delightful. You just have to watch it.
So, two of mine you talked about already.
Oh, Tokyo Drifter, huh?
Other two. Yeah, Pigs and Battleships, because, again, that was, for me, a huge surprise. It's just, I didn't expect it to be as great as it was. I think The Pornographers is about on par with it. It's both directed by Imamura. They're both very similar. And I think I prefer Pigs and Battleships slightly more. I think it's a funnier one of the two. But they're both really great. But, Pigs just edged out just barely. It really needs to be seen. I'm not sure how famous that movie is, but should be more well-known. Yeah. Good Morning. Because that's just Ozu at his most delightful. And Ozu is simply very delightful. And this is just... I don't know if this it's just works. I don't think it's his best movie. I think Tokyo Twilight is a better movie and has more to say. Where Good Morning is just, you know, Ozu having a whole lot of fun.
It's just a slice of life with fart jokes. What else do you want? Can you do?
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned it. Great kid actors, great performances out of them. They're not irritating. Ever. They're very, very likable. They're very, they manage to be like children, but not irritating, which is just an incredible feat. I don't know how he did that.
Yeah.
And, the third is Sendaka number 8. I first saw this movie maybe like 2 years ago on, Hulu. And it really surprised me. I like that it's in that tradition of like a Japanese tragedy about a woman in prostitution, and it incorporates something I love, history, and it manages to tell the history of Japan turning into a militaristic dictatorship through telling the story of this woman's life. And I just appreciate that movie more and more every time I see it. And the lead actress, Kinoyu Tanaka, who played the old woman, she is she directed, I think, maybe five feature films, and she is the first Japanese woman to direct a feature film. And we've seen her in multiple movies, and she's just always really great in this, seeing her in her, I think her final before one of her last performances, it was just very, like, very delightful in this scene. Her just really, like, I never seen her play the same role twice. Like, she's very versatile, and I don't think she gets enough credit now. I think she gets overshadowed by Setsuko, which makes sense. But, you know, there are other Japanese actresses from, like, the 50s and 60s who, you know, deserve attention. And Sendak Number 8 just tells the story of women, where a lot of Japanese movies that wouldn't be willing to tell the story of women in quite the way it does.
You don't have to watch any other movies except for the ones we just met. No, I'm just kidding. 1 year.
It's been 1 year.
That means we've only done 24 movies. Wait, 26? 26 movies.
Something like
that. Yeah, that's not true. We've done like 30-something. 38.
I know. And I think we have a year left.
At least.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's been a year.
Yeah, I have terrible keeping track of time, especially when it comes to podcasting.
Yeah, I guess the saying is true. Time flies when you're having fun. Shut up.
Okay. This is our last episode now. You ruined everything.
Okay. The next episode, we're going to talk about... I lost it. 1990s Dreams with Aaron Gambrill from Lazy Library. And that episode will come out... If I'm following schedule exactly, it'll come on Christmas, but it'll come out a little couple days before Christmas, because Christmas is, you know, people are busy with stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
And the other film is a movie called Heat Wave from 1990 or 91, I forgot which, by Gosha, who did Hunter in the Dark, and Heat Wave stars Nakadai. And it's Heatwave is on Filmstruck, Dreams is on Amazon, and Heatwave, I think, is still available on DVD through Criterion. In terms of, there are other movies called Heatwave, so it's Heatwave from 1990. Just look up Nakadai Heatwave 90s,
You're also not talking about the Transformer.
And not the song. And, yeah, that will be the...
Huh? That goes without saying. It's not the song.
Yeah, we got stuff to plug.
No, not really. I mean, I guess if you want to listen to me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies, you could listen to Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space. Every Monday, except for this Monday, because there was a huge fire, we release new episodes about your favorite movies, like Quincy's Quest and The Tenth Victim. And Logan. Oh, mate, that's a movie people have actually heard of. Yeah, we've been doing a lot of recent stuff. We just did Colossal. We did Logan. We did Ex Machina. Yeah, one of our favorites at this house. So,
are you going to do Scott Pilgrim?
I mean, yeah, probably eventually.
For me, there's Jailhouse 701. I just drop the review for Rika 2, Lonely Wanderer. And in the next few weeks, will be the review for Rika 3, Juvenile Lullaby, and the follow-up piece on the Rika series that, if you're sensitive to discussion of rape and sexual assault, just be warned, because the movie is heavily based on the how like rape and sexual assault were horrifically underreported and not treated seriously by the American government in post-war Japan. And the movie is about like what would happen to a child born out situation. And the movies are more fun, but the backdrop is kind of really grim and serious. And yeah, the movies are interesting. They're on DVD. I recommend it if you can handle some kind of serious subject matter and weird tonal changes into like some real grim stuff.
I cannot.
Oh yeah, Alistair's podcast started up, and on the Russophiles podcast, and I am on episode seven. Seven or eight? I didn't get invited. I forgot which one. Aren't you asking?
Yeah, I don't want to ask him. Obviously, he doesn't like me.
Okay. But yeah, I will show up on that podcast in about 2 months or so. I don't know his release schedule yet. He's on like episode 3.
I see.
Anyway, yeah. And Grindbin, episode 74. And I'm trying to work on an appearance on Filmwise with Martin Kessler, talking about African films, and we're trying to work out what African films we're going to talk about exactly. So look out for that. Someone Knife Fight this month. I'm covering this CBC Canadian animated special from 77. That is kind of awful, but I forgot the title of it. I'll put it up somewhere like on the episode notes. So, yeah. That's
all
it.
All right.
Happy 1 year anniversary.
To you too. Or are you talking to the audience?
One more year. Whoever. And hopefully we have one more year, because literally we have roughly a year left.
Yeah, we already have plans for what we're doing next, so.
Yeah. Oh, and the Studio Ghibli special will happen at some point. I just need to get hold of
Don't make promises you can't keep. Oh, okay.
Because Studio Ghibli stuff isn't streaming anywhere, yep. It turns out. You have to physically buy it. So, yeah, we're going to do a Studio Ghibli special. I might have some guests return. Might have a new guest. I don't know yet, so working on that. Yeah. That's all. Alfie Zane, hashtag Thug Life, Knock Die Forever. You can email the show at highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on iTunes, Podbean, Podient, but only on Podient for the next month as of this recording, and wherever else you find your podcast. Thank you for listening.